But, you know, it's 30 to 23. My mom, what a Freudian slip. My wife texted me and she said, "What's your plan?" And honestly, my plan is to walk in front of a fucking bus. Because the first half of this game for Nebraska, it was like eating a bucket of feedlot shit. You know, with the gravel and everything in it, it was a terrible first half. And then the second half, we came out, we did like we did against Michigan. We started scoring points, we started moving the ball, and ultimately it wasn't enough as we gave up that big run. I like the way that Minnesota mixes up their quarterbacks between Morgan and Kramer, because Kramer, you know, makes you confused. You think he's going to keep the ball, and then bam, he hands it off. He throws it. In the first half, I'll say this. Honest to God, in the first half, I'm not making this up. At one point, I thought, I'm just going to go in, take my camera gear off, and quit all of this shit, because it's really hard to take. And I was just going to take all my clothes off and leave the stadium. I probably wouldn't have got far, and people would have gone, my God, nobody needs to see that. But again, does anybody need to see this shit anymore? We need to learn how to win games. One score games. I don't know. Look at them. They're all down there having fun, the motherfuckers. I guess, congratulations, you Minnesota goof bastards. Who thought this Nebraska team could score 38 points against Minnesota? What kind of a jackass would make that prediction? I thought Bowling Green, Minnesota, to show up. What the hell was I thinking? There's no hope. Fuck everything.
Hello and welcome to the Pants Party. I am your host, Harrison Starr, aka HD underscore Starr, joined as always by Ben Ross, aka RenBoss23. And the intro you heard was John Johnston of Corn Nation after Nebraska's loss to Minnesota from their YouTube. It was incredible. We're going to start there and then get to the Iowa game, because I watched more of the Nebraska-Minnesota game live than I did the Iowa-Purdue game. I did watch the Iowa-Purdue game eventually. And let me just say, Nebraska is the most fun team to watch in all of college football. I'm committed to that take.
I mean, I'll fight you on that. I watched absolutely zero of Nebraska-Minnesota game. I watched zero college football this weekend other than Iowa-Purdue. And I went into the Iowa-Purdue game assuming I'd only have to watch a quarter because my mom was in town. So I sort of treated her, I don't know how to put this in lighter terms, like a puppy, and tried to get her tired all morning, took her shopping to all of her favorite stores all around Chicago. And her favorite boutique, I knew, was next to a sports bar of some repute in a Chicago neighborhood. So made sure she was knuckles deep in some shiny things for the first quarter while I could sneak away and watch the game. And as it went, I was like, I just can't leave this game. And thankfully, there were more stores to occupy my mom's time. And that was the only football I watched all weekend, including NFL. I spent Sunday in a pumpkin patch. And that's just, I spent it there. I took a nap. That's where I spent my Sunday, trying to get as far away from society as possible and keep my mind off of these artists formerly known as the number two Iowa Hawkeyes.
I guess we should talk about that. Like I said, I didn't watch the game live because we were at a wedding, but I watched enough of it on enough cell phone videos and bar televisions out of the corner of my eye, telling myself, if I don't pay attention, they're actually going to win. And that didn't work. It really didn't work, because obviously they lost in excruciating fashion. And I thought, man, when I rewatch it, it's going to feel and look exactly as I think it did. And Ben, I can't believe it, but like it was so much worse than I expected. I have some numbers. I did some capital podcasting that I want to walk through, but like I'm blown away by how that game felt like a 49-7 hand blasting, and yet it was still only 24-7.
I mean, the game was never close. I mean, really, right? Like, there was a part of me, I will say, after the fumble onto the pylon, which I agree is a very dumb rule, but when that happened, for a brief flitter of a moment, I thought to myself, there's no way I would lose this game now. It was, I think, only a 14-point game then, and maybe 10 as a two-score game. And I thought, this is what stupid Iowa does. Thinking back to 2009, the interception to Indiana interceptions, the pinballing into Tyler Sash's hands, and any other. We can take any other examples of stupid games that Iowa has had no business winning, and they've gone back to win. However, none of those other teams had a David Bell or a Jeff Grom, the catalyst is, I guess, Iowa still has Brian Ferentz, and I mean, as much as we like to shower him with words of praise, still has a Phil Parker, who, for whatever reason, thinks he can single cover an All-American wide receiver. So, I mean, this is the devil that we know, and flying sky high as I was following the win over Penn State, I am as low as I am now. However, if this doesn't make – I was thinking about it this morning where I was still – I was angrier on the podcast last week.
Yes.
After a win.
Yes.
Than I am now. Because I think now I'm just depressed. Now I'm sad. Now I'm back to why did I let the feelings get the best of me? Why – did I let Iowa do what Iowa always does to me, which is, and I mentioned this in some writing I wrote this week, where I have constructed a timeline of my
own. This is a lie, though.
Harrison. Well, here's the thing when you rebut me. And okay. My timeline starts with Iowa football fandom as a blurry-eyed freshman in the year. Blah, 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 blah. And you say, you know, but you lived through 1998 and the Gary Anderson missed kick with the Vikings. And my rebuttal to that is, well, I was only maybe about a year old when that happened. I was too young and I didn't, you know, really know what sports were.
Okay. Yeah, you got me there. I mean, it's... Here, I'm kind of with you. Like, I was angry, and I think it was around the sentiment around Iowa more than, oh, actually angry at the team or angry at Penn State or angry at yada, yada, yada. It was like, oh, Iowa is still just Iowa in the national landscape. And to your point, the beginning of your sports fandom sadness starting with Iowa is fair, because like whenever they fly close to the sun, those wax wings melt in hilarious fashion. I mean, I think Matt Reisner had an interesting column and saying it was one of the worst, if not the worst, loss in Iowa history. And I think it's interesting because they had never been on, even at this point, the inside looking out from a college football playoff standpoint. And then you look at it from, well, some of the other really bad losses were to fine teams, right? Christian McCaffrey, that's one that's like, oh, that's an embarrassing loss. And I think probably one that a lot of people would probably say is the Ronnie Harmon UCLA game, where similar sentiment kind of to the Rose Bowl of 2016, where it's like, ooh, that's brutal. But I think that the reason this one was so bad was, but also not so bad, because we have all the checklist. It's like, all right, opponent who understands Iowa better than themselves. Just elite player who can take over a game. Quarterback that can dink and dunk. Defensive lineman who can flip the field. Like, it was like they had the exact checklist that you want to beat Iowa, which makes it simultaneously less frustrating and more frustrating because, as you said at the top, Phil Parker, for all his faults, or for all of the praise and all that he is good at, Purdue exposes his scabs year after year. And I do ultimately kind of settle on, like, you look at him from a basketball defensive standpoint. In my opinion, Phil Parker has created a defense that can stop field goals or stop layups and stop three-pointers, which are the two highest value shots on the floor. But Purdue is a team that lives in the mid-range and is great in the mid-range, and Phil Parker is happy to give those shots. Well, you have a guy like David Bell who can turn a little crosser at the line of scrimmage into a 60-yard gain, and it gets ugly. Now, I think they actually missed the field goal after that shot, or after that shot, after that pass, but nothing felt like more of a microcosm than that little play, because it's one where, hey, you're happy to give him that pass, but it's like how he can be with letting quarterbacks scramble kind of early in games where there's this huge swath of land that they just eat up and make you feel horrible about.
Do we just have to accept that Iowa sports being affiliated with the number two is bad luck? Because what happened when your Iowa Hawkeye basketball team got a 2 seed this year, Harrison?
They lost in the second round after being favored. And like, I was thinking about this because it is a great point that, like, Iowa basketball has had their fatal flaw throughout all of the last 2 years, which was athleticism, which was defense. Like, let's not paint around it. It was defense first, particularly at the guard position. And the only way to counteract that was just to outscore teams like Oregon. Well, when you get outscored like Iowa did in that game, it has the very same feel as what happens against Purdue. And I think it's a similar sentiment because Iowa still had, like, I don't think there was like a little Iowa type of feel necessarily that existed in March, but there was that I think it's a dangerous brew for Iowa fans where you have to, like, be a little chestier than normal to, like, we're a good team. And I felt it with us. Like, I even was, like, selling myself on the offense. Like, the offense isn't as bad as it is. I mean, they had the two biggest plays against Penn State all season. But they couldn't swing it. And it makes me sad, but I think it also is a bucket of cold water on national expectations receding into the background and more, I'll use this word because it frustrated me seeing it on the Twitter earlier with regards to Brian Ferentz at the podium, more relevant goals are now in place as it stands for Iowa. Because, hey, the Big Ten's still there for the taking. You need Purdue to lose a game, which stinks, but that's the way it goes. And maybe that comes this week, and maybe Iowa's back to being a team that can control its own destiny. But ultimately, let's win the West and see where it is from there. Because from a national perspective, it did hurt in that regard.
If both Iowa and Purdue go on to win the rest of their games, and Purdue makes it to Indy, I'm going to be so fucking mad. But beyond that, the broader point is, I think you're the only person who I've seen really say this and then stick by it, is 2 or 3 weeks ago you mentioned, this is a normal Iowa team that just so happens to be ranked number two. at the time. And now, dropping 9 fucking spots, which I don't agree with, I guess, but I do agree with the number 11 ranking, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, how, Penn State dropped, what, 4 spots?
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
number 6, right?
Yeah, but here's ultimately where it comes down to, is like, as I've said, Iowa flying too close to the sun, that's part of it, and they were overranked. But 11 feels right, even if you, like, say, oh, they lost to Purdue in week 2. 11 still feels right because they still have the wins that they do against the teams that they do. Like, if Iowa
State's getting better by the week.
Yes.
If they beat Oklahoma State this weekend, that's, like, one of the best wins in all of college football.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so, ultimately, 11 feels right because the teams ahead of them are the Power 5 undefeateds and then the Blue Blood one-loss teams. So, 11 feels right. Like, but to go from 2 to 11, it's like, oh, yeah, that was ugly. And I think, like, historically, this was something that Stoops had emailed me. Like, it was one of the biggest drops that a 2-seed or a 2-ranked team has ever had. I don't care to necessarily fact-check it because I think it would just depress me.
I wonder what number 2 Boston College dropped after they lost with Matt Ryan. Do you just want to read the whole Stoops email? No, never mind. Oh, that was a joke.
There's a lot.
I know. I'm sure there is. I guess. I mean, aren't we underdog already? Like, 1 week. I know it's a week away because we've got the bye, but aren't we underdogs now to Wisconsin too? Like, it's just wild stuff the way they're letting this. When I say they, I'm waving my hands in the air, gesturing to nobody or nothing in particular. But it's just crazy how it's totally changed the narrative. I'm not seeing a line yet at least on my application for the Iowa Wisconsin game. But it's just so crazy that it feels like Iowa fans were overreacting to us being undefeated, and now everyone who wasn't an Iowa fan is overreacting to Iowa losing a game, which always happens. And the worst part is they're all vindicated. Everyone, I fucking made a hit list of all the media last week who didn't believe in Iowa. And now they're all right.
Yeah, Saturday morning I was so mad at what Lee Corso was saying. And then he was right. It's like, God dang it. But the thing is, it's so easy to be against Iowa. Like, I mean, I think that's at the butt of this frustration, is like, it's easy to be like, no, Iowa is actually not as good as they are.
The most frustrating part for me, and I don't want to divulge into this topic too much because we did it ad nauseum last year when it happened. But all of a sudden, after Iowa became number 2 and then lost a game, people were dragging the skeletons out of Kirk Ferentz's closet about what happened to the locker room during the 2020, you know, reckoning. And it's like, nobody had brought that up at all between then and now. And now that Iowa is good, like, I'm going to name drop him. Jason Kirk, who didn't bring it up once at all, ever. I listen to his podcast religiously and read his writing religiously, brought it up for the very first time ever after Iowa lost. Like, totally and completely kicking Iowa and Kirk Ferentz and Brian while they're down. And I'm not saying that the allegations are ever unfair or anything. And we saw this out of Penn State fans too, which is really fucking rich. But the fact of the matter is like, now that Iowa has finally turned into a pumpkin, which is something I love to say, they are pointing out all the other warts that appear on the dirt that appears on that pumpkin. And it's something I don't really like because, you know, do I believe Iowa will run the table rest of the year? I don't know. But if that happens, I think they're going to be pointing at that giant zit on the face of this program and franchise. And, you know, the I will say, you know, like, I don't want to say it because I don't want to bring up any more of the stupid media members I listen to or read. But you know, a couple of them, you know, do, we're defending that. They would sort of share my sentiment on that, how it is weird that once a team is sort of exposed like this. Like, for example, actually, this is sort of relevant. After finally Ed Orgeron got fired this week, or, I mean, you know, whatever you want to call his separation, even though he's going to coach the rest of the year.
Living out the lease.
When we is all, and I don't know if you've read the Athletic story, but this is the first time we heard about him hitting on the wives of boosters, bringing girlfriends to practice, letting 9 and 11-year-olds participate in drills in his practices. Like, that was all kept under wraps until, like, this bad thing happened to him. And I think it's just so weird that, and like, everything, like, especially the story about him hitting on, like, a booster's wife, that incredibly relevant, you know? But the fact that the media kept under wraps until, and like, the greater narrative kept it a secret until, oh, he's going to get fired now so I can reveal this, is just so strange. And it's, you know, not a one-to-one comparison app. I think it's not quite at one-to-one, but it's a little bit closer than apples to oranges with what's going on with the narrative surrounding around Iowa and Kirk Ferentz and Brian. And again, I'm not a Kirk or Brian apologist. If you've listened and read anything I wrote, you know I'm not. But I just feel, since we're blogging about this team, I feel like we've got a much better pulse on what's going on than anybody else.
I think you're right. There's some level of one-to-one, but the Orgeron thing smacks of like what you see from you see this every time someone gets fired. All of the weird stories, no matter how relevant or not, come up to the surface. With the Kirk thing, it made sense last season as it was happening, as Iowa was losing games to open the season. It made sense to kind of continually bring it up because there is that air over it. But now we have 13 games since Iowa had those two losses. ISM had his DUI. There was a narrative to construct that there was a weird locker room situation going on. I don't know how you can retcon yourself into thinking that, oh, Iowa, somehow though, in the midst of a weird locker room, Iowa has been able to win 12 straight games before losing this 13th one. Well, Chad Leistikow wrote at the beginning of the season that he hadn't seen an Iowa team closer. So, yeah. It seems weird for any national voice to kind of bring it up, and I don't think it necessarily deserves much more discussion here. That will run its course as it run its course, and I think, what is it, the deposition got postponed until after the season. So more to come on that way later. I do want to kind of dive into some of the specifics as it pertains to the Iowa-Purdue game, because I was blown away reading or watching the game. I went ahead and kind of charted it because I thought, hey, if I'm going to put myself through this and do it, I'm going to come out with more information than just a take, especially since I did it in the 60-minute one. You know, it's like you watch that 60-minute reel, you can't get a feel of the ebbs and flows necessarily. It's like boom, 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 because I know wind was a factor, etc. But I think the first broad yet minor thing that sticks out is as I was tracking the plays, 17 of 19 shotgun snaps were passes. And the other one that was jarring is under center. Let me make sure I have this. Under center, 23 of 27 were rushes. So, based on where Iowa's quarterback is an incredible tell. Now, is this a symptom or is it a disease? Is probably up for debate. But one thing that blows my mind away, and this is always kind of what I come back to with Iowa's offensive scheme, is they never make it easy for Iowa to move yards. They just simply don't. It's like, if we're in a passing formation, we're going to pass. I mean, I just think about, all right, if I'm George Karloftis and I see Spencer Petras in the shotgun, I just have to get to that spot. Like, I just have to beat my man, get to that spot, and because my cornerbacks see the quarterback also in shotgun, all they have to do is guard their man for a second and a half, and I can blow this play up, and it'll be over. And then it blows my mind that Iowa could be so telegraphed. And this is where it feels a little weird, because this type of analysis was being done as Greg Davis was put out to pasture, and I have not seen that done from a media standpoint quite yet. And it is just one game. I understand that, like, I just did this for one game, but man, it was wild to see those stats come out like that. And the one of the two shotgun runs that they had was at the goal line. So, like, in a running situation with like 22 personnel. So it's just like, it's frustrating, because all the concerns we have about Iowa's offense were exacerbated by that exercise that I went through.
A couple things I want to follow up. First, I can now just imagine Brian Ferentz as KGB John Malkovich from Rounders eating Oreos on the sideline, and the Purdue defensive coordinator knowing exactly what his tell is. Second, I mean, I want to ask you, you bring up the how telegraphed Iowa's plays are going to be based on the location of Spencer Petras in shotgun or under center. What does that tell you about the strengths and weaknesses of this Iowa team?
So I think if I'm going to not find blame in Brian Ferentz with this play calling and shift it, to me what it says is that Spencer Petras can't operate under center as a passer. And I think that there's that piece to it. And then I think there's the other where, or the extension of that, which is the plays Iowa likes to run with a quarterback under center, primarily play action stuff, are things that he can't play off schedule from. So, but other than that, it's just an incredible tell to have. And like I said, just one game, Iowa operated with a basic game plan. And I think that that's kind of where it is. If I'm not going to be kind of focused on that, I guess they're not focused on the Brian aspect of it. There's probably some math to, well, if you have a guy in shotgun, you can get the ball out quicker from, and you can protect your offensive line a little bit from a pass rushing standpoint, but you still have to keep the defensive front honest with more runs out of the shotgun.
There, I don't think this is why I lost, but there was an abandonment of, you know, the Wildcat too, but I don't think Wildcat would have done anything against this Purdue team. But I mean, I want to go back to what you said. You know, you said that it shows you that Spencer Petras can't operate under center, but are you saying he can't operate under center, or he can't operate when he's got no blocking?
Because I mean, that's...
I think you're kind of jumping through hoops to avoid the topic here.
No, to me, it starts with Brian Ferentz. But if I'm going to try and unpeel the layers to it and explore everything, like, maybe it isn't just Brian Ferentz, but to me, to have such a tell is Brian Ferentz. Like, if it weren't him, we would see a closer to 50-50 split from a run standpoint out of the shotgun. Especially for a team that likes to assert balance.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he knows, Brian knows better than anyone else, except for us, because we're much smarter than he is. The strengths and weaknesses of what his team is. And to sort of go back to what you're alluding to, how there hasn't been sort of the criticisms, Brian hasn't suffered the same criticisms that his predecessor has in sort of the media, and obviously they're definitely deserved. I think part of it is just like, one, it's sort of futile, I think, to be critical. Like, nothing's going to change. Kirk's not going to fire his son. So there's that, and then there's going back to him. He's done, to his credit, he's done a really good job of being an ambassador for the program between his wife and the tragedy with his daughter and things like that. And there's a commenter on the site this week about how after the Penn State game, he literally bumped heads into Brian on the campus of Kinnick, and Brian spoke with him for 5 entire minutes right after leaving the facility, pretending like they were as if they were old friends catching up. So he's done a really good job. And then finally, there's other people like yourself there's people who reference his podcast, 3-hour-long podcast with Chad every opportunity they can.
Yes.
So he's done, and great. Yeah. Speaking of vindication, I feel extremely vindicated having not listened to a single second of that podcast. For this very reason, because I knew, again, he was a pumpkin. And Greg Davis never did that. And he didn't have that job security, and he didn't have that last name. And we talk about all the time, you go to war with the army you have. Brian's a fucking general. And it sucks. It really sucks.
Yeah, and like, I mean, I think that there are two things. There's like the criticism that I kind of levied, but I think there's also the criticism to be had on Brian's terms. And when I say that, I think about, hey, is Iowa hitting on the opportunities they have, which are, call it 3 to 5 drives per game, and are they hitting on the big plays that they need to hit on? And to me, the most concerning thing, and I understand like some of this is, you know, amidst the end of game situations that Iowa has been in over the last couple of games, but red zone scoring is down to 65%, which is good for like 118th in the country. That is not good when you look at it from a last three and last one perspective. I think Iowa hit on 1 out of 5 times in the red zone on Saturday, and I think it was 4-9, if I remember correctly, if you include the Penn State and Maryland games before that. Those are not winning numbers for Iowa. They just aren't, and it's the type of thing that is a criticism on his terms, where you say you need to be good in the red zone, and you've been really quite bad in the red zone. And frankly, I don't see much optimism for that improving, considering that the two teams coming up are teams that match Iowa in a way that Purdue matches Iowa from a patient standpoint, from a stylistic standpoint, that they're able to kind of hit at similar scabs that Phil Parker may have. And they're also very complementary football teams in terms of, hey, using the offense to help the defense and things like that. I thought that was maybe an underrated thing from this past game, where Purdue strung out long possessions with incredible, not really efficiency, because they took a lot of time, took a lot of plays, but their ability to continue drives was a huge part of that. I think it was 9 of 13 that had it before they went into kick it away mode. So when I look at it from that respect,
they were nine of 16 on third down, even in kick it away mode, which shit, you take that all day.
Yeah. Yeah. So it asks so much of the defense to be great every single time they're on the field that it's easy to see why people are pessimistic going forward. I don't know where I stand yet. I think I've maybe leaned a little too much into negativity so far, but Iowa lost, and it's honestly kind of hard. The only positives are, well, nothing went their way. And how many more games can Iowa have where nothing goes their way, but really things went their way? They just didn't capitalize on them.
Yeah, I mean, Brom poked every single hole he could in this defense, and I think I don't want to keep on harping on Brian, and Brian happily exposed every single hole in the offense. Like, I think I don't want to, you know, it's so classic for us to be literally armchair quarterbacks, but I really don't think this is a tough game for the Purdue coaches to coach. And the track record against Iowa, I think, proves my fact. And it's like, this is the type of thing, like, you can think about how many coaches have lost jobs because they just couldn't beat their rival. I'm trying to think off the top of my head. It's like, you always say, like, if you take the Florida State job, all you have to do is beat Florida. And vice versa. Or if you take it doesn't really work that way between Wisconsin and Minnesota, unfortunately. But, like, Michigan and Ohio State's a great example. I said going into the year, the only thing that's going to save Harbaugh's job is beating Ohio State. I think that's wrong now because he's done an incredible job everywhere else. But all you have to do between Ohio State and Michigan, really all you had to do is beat one or the other every few years. Whereas now, Purdue, who's not even a rival, never really, no, not a rival to anybody, but maybe Indiana, and that's only because they're in state and it's just two cellar dwellers of the program. But now it's like, and Brom sort of like saved his own job he was on the hot seat going into the year. And now all of a sudden they're 4-2 and in the driver's seat in the West. And like, that's the type of thing that get coaches fired at schools that don't have a coach who's been your coach for 25 years and counting.
I think Nicholas had this stat in the comments where it was half of Brom's conference wins are against Iowa and Illinois.
Insane.
What incredible company for Kirk Ferentz to keep in Brom's Big Ten tenure. Incredible. I think I had it and I forgot it. But like, ultimately, this bye week is just, it's coming at the right time, and from a like thought perspective, like what can be done though? Like, ultimately, what can be done, do you think, for Iowa to trend up the rest of the season, get to the conference championship game? Because as I said kind of at the top, this being a reset of goals, get to Indianapolis, it's still there, but as a glass half empty type statement, Iowa's only controlled their destiny once in November in 11 seasons since the divisions have been in place. So I'm just got to beat Wisconsin, I guess. I mean, like, I just don't know how that'll happen. I mean, I do, but I don't.
I mean, selfishly, yeah, I think the season's a complete and total loss unless we make it to Indy. One more loss in the regular season, I think, is sort of unacceptable for what we've seen, how this team can play. Barring, you know, further substantial extenuating circumstances between injuries and maybe other weird things that could happen between then and the end. Now in the end, I mean, but I don't even remember what your question was.
I mean, I guess, like, is there anything you want to see Iowa index on going forward as a football team that we've seen either glimmers of or not? Like, what do you think will turn Iowa into that team that's representing the West, other than just a reversion to, well, let's just hope the turnovers keep running like they did the first six games?
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I don't think there's anything Iowa can do. Like, they've showed us, they've already sort of, now I'm talking myself out of going on to the rest of the year. They've already reached a peak. Like, I don't think, you know, I want to say get the ball to Keegan Johnson and Arvin Bruce more, but I don't think that's going to result in more wins necessarily. Getting them the ball more over Nico Reganey and Tyrone Trace is not getting the ball at all, so that doesn't really matter. I want to say, like, other than just like the offensive line playing better, like a lot better, which I don't really think will happen. Other than just saying the players play better, there's really nothing I can do. It's not like in years past where we can say, like, Phil Parker needs to blitz more and Iowa needs to give Akram Wahlby the ball more, or give Amir Smith Marset the ball more, or Nate Stanley. Like, really, it's been like sort of, you know, Nate Stanley just had to play better and Iowa's going to be better. It's just as simple. Most of the time it's as simple. God damn it. What does Kirk Ferentz always fucking say after they lose a game and we get mad at them about?
Team game.
No, execution, but yes.
Yeah. Yeah. The execution stuff just cracks me up. Because, like, a part of the charting exercise...
It's the perfect response. It's the perfect response because, well, if so-and-so did this instead of that, then we would have won. So it's execution. Like, it's chess. It's every single game in the history of games. Is if one thing didn't happen that did happen... then it would, the outcome would be different. That is everything in all of life.
Well, I even think about, like, the Purdue game could not have started worse for Iowa than it did, right? Like, they got the ball moving, and then they throw an interception, which, to his credit, he hasn't done early like he did. And that kind of set the tone, right? Because, hey, you're driving, you don't come away with points. Your kicker, I think the next drive or two, he doesn't convert. So you're looking at minimum, Iowa should have probably had a 6-0 lead or something. And they are stuck down 7-0. And this was always kind of the criticism of Iowa, and the way to counter it is just play football the way Iowa plays football, but don't let them score first. And that's what Purdue did. And I guess that's just, how does Iowa place an emphasis on scoring earlier, more points? I don't know. Like, I mean, to your point, execution. If that ball's a foot lower than it is, it's probably a catch. And we... we're probably still talking about an Iowa loss, but just under a different circumstance.
Here's something else I want to talk about that I haven't really seen written, or I will be on. I'm being very, what's the word, childish. I guess I wanted, this would be therapeutic for me to say, like, after every Saturday, so, you know, every Sunday morning, I've been reading everything I can about the Iowa Hawkeyes and just like greater college football landscape in general, listening to all the podcasts that I've name dropped earlier. I just can't get enough of anything college, tangentially college football related. Also part of that too is like Georgia, who I mean is like my second favorite team. They're amazing too. So that's been fun for me. But this past Sunday, no podcasts, no reading. I haven't, the only article I've read on The Athletic this week has been about the Minnesota Wild and like the Ed Orgeron story. I haven't read any Iowa media content. I haven't even read, I'll be honest, like I've read Matt Reisner's piece and I don't think I've read anybody, and I couldn't even read all the comments on our website other than I banned like 10 Penn State commenters who, you're the saddest motherfuckers around. Go get a life, you fucking losers. I have your work emails saved to my account. was going to say, the thing that I haven't read, and if it has, if you have seen somewhere, correct me, Purdue, they had three quarterbacks better than Iowa's one on Saturday. And that's a fucking problem, Harrison. That's a huge fucking problem. Aiden O'Connell made throws that we haven't seen an Iowa quarterback make since C.J. Beathard circa 2015. Not C.J. Beathard 2016 even. Like, we haven't had a – how does Purdue have three better quarterbacks than Iowa's had in the past 6 years on one roster?
Who's the head coach? The head coach – I mean,
you're right.
This is just –
you're absolutely right.
This is just where it comes down to, like, when you have the system that you have for as long as you do, if you're Kirk Ferentz or even if you're Jeff Brohm. Jeff Brohm can go into any living room and tell the quarterback or the wide receiver, you are going to be involved. I'm going to make you the focal point of your offense. If you listen to me, I will make you a good college quarterback. Versus Iowa, you have, hey, if you block, you'll see the field for a wide receiver. And if you learn the playbook and are a coach on the field, then you might be able to play as a quarterback. Like, the value statements that Iowa attributes to the quarterback versus what Jeff Brohm attributes to the quarterback, it's so different. It's so different. And it's funny because, like, this Purdue team had operated so differently prior to this with, I think that they might have the best scoring defense in the conference. Now, I haven't checked. But when you have a scheme and a philosophy that is enticing to 18-year-olds, that's how you get better quarterbacks than Iowa has, because Iowa's scheme is not enticing. And like I talked about or tweet about this from the wedding, because how could I not see that David Pell was just like putting up yards and yards and yards. But Iowa hasn't had someone over 1,000 receiving yards since Marvin McNutt in 2011. And the most they've had since then were like a couple between 700 and 800 yards. Now, I understand 1,000 is a lot to accumulate over a year, but between 700 and 800, that is 60 yards a game. How can you credibly go into a wide receiver's living room and say, we're going to turn you into an NFL wide receiver when you can't even get 60 yards a game? I mean, Brandon Smith on the outskirts and Amir Smith-Marset, he's only in the league because he's like got breakaway speed and a kick returner. So, like, Iowa's cultivated a scheme and whatnot where it just devalues skill position players, quarterbacks included, and it's hard to do it. I genuinely don't know how Arlen Bruce and Keegan Johnson are on the roster, because those guys are electric players and underutilized. But to your point, does more Keegan Johnson make Iowa better and turn this into a win, or turn games that might not be wins into wins? Who knows? It probably just comes down to not making mistakes.
I just live fact checked you, and since 2011, nobody's touched 800 yards receiving. Amir Smith-Marset got 722 in 2019. The most since 2011 is 760 yards. Oh, and do you know who owns that? Do you know who owns that?
Was that Keenan Davis or Tavon Smith?
Not a wide receiver. Tight end T.J. Hankinson.
Yeah. Yep.
So you're right. Like, how? And then I want to mention Aiden O'Connell was a walk-on at Purdue. So we do is talk about how great these Iowa coaches are at recruiting undervalued, overlooked players. And that, talk about pumpkins, that's another freaking pumpkin too, I think, Harrison. And you're right. It is incredible that we do have more, like, like if Keegan Johnson and Arlen Bruce are out at Purdue right now, are they in freshman All-American conversation like Rondale Moore is? Like, honestly, like, do we have to wonder, do we have to be nervous about them transferring at the end? I don't think necessarily transferring from a team that's right now ranked number 11 with one loss is ridiculous speak. But if this season could easily snowball, just as easily, I think snowballing is probably maybe a little bit more likely than Iowa going undefeated rest of the way, right? So
yeah,
I think obviously somewhere in between is the most likely outcome, where Iowa probably loses two more games or one more game rest of the year. But I mean, you're right. This team needs to have sort of a reckoning with, and then furthermore, I mean, the entire offense is stinky with the way, I mean, Kirk Ferentz has made his entire living off this myth. He's the best offensive line coach in the country. And I mean, you've put in the slack. When was the last time Iowa had an elite offensive line? Like 2004? So
yeah.
It's just pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean,
sort of apologizing what this coaching staff can do when we watch in our own two eyes. I mean, we sort of watch them stab us in the back every single, not every weekend, but you know, it's kind of like clockwork. You could probably set the clock by getting let down by this football team, and it's always from the exact same way is the most frustrating part.
I'm gonna set my watch to the game in West Lafayette next year, because probably gonna go to that. I'm probably not going to enjoy it because Jeff Brohm, unless he's gone,
that's a lose-lose proposition for you.
Yeah, I mean, because worst case, best case, Iowa's won and I'm still in West Lafayette, which is a town that exists right, with a college in it. I mean, I think the thing that's wild, and like you can't look at the negatives of the Kirk Ferentz system without like necessarily looking at the positives of it. And I think the fact that Iowa hadn't been embarrassed in the way that they were embarrassed on Saturday since probably, I would say, 2016, that Florida bowl game. I think that there are so many.
I disagree. Hold on, I want to stop you there. I disagree. Any loss to Purdue is embarrassing.
Okay.
No matter the circumstances.
But it was 17 points. Like, I mean, that was a big loss at home as the number two team. I don't think that there's...
Okay, yes, you're right, okay. But I mean, it was a meaningless bowl game to an SEC team, but whatever.
Fair enough. But, I mean, I think it's hard to be like rag on the offense when... What I did watch enough of that game on Saturday. I'm like, the offense doesn't look that much different than it's looked all season, but it was worse. Like, it was worse. And that's kind of the spectrum that Kirk Ferentz puts the offense in the bind of, hey, we're going to ask you to operate at a potentially suboptimal level. So when it actually is bad, it looks really, 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 really bad. Instead of just, oh, we got the yards, but we turned it over all the time. Like, I mean, I think that it's tough because especially in a game like where the wind played a factor, just, but again, why is Iowa's scheme or game-to-game philosophy so built on field position and kicking the ball when it's in the upper Midwest and the wind is going to play a factor in, what, 50% of games in October and November?
I guess you're right. Sort of as you laid out your argument there, it's like, what was this game missing? It was missing an incredible Charlie Jones to catch a la Iowa State. It was missing a perfectly timed play call from Brian Ferentz a la Nico Reganey last week, or Nick Easley against Mississippi State in another meaningless bowl game against an SEC team a few years ago. It was missing an incredible run from Tyler Goodson that we saw maybe, or run after the catch that we saw against Maryland. It was missing, you know, incredible acrobatic interceptions from Riley Moss, who didn't play. And I don't think the outcome would have been any different at all if he did play. Let me make that clear. It was missing incredible. So an acrobatic interception or a great play from Matt Hankins, let's say, or Dane Belton. So, and it was missing perfection from Caleb Chudak, and it was missing perfection from Torrey Taylor. And so when you add all those things up, which are negatives, when you take all those negatives, it turns into one big fat Iowa L.
Yeah. I mean, I think that frames it up nicely. It's frustrating, like, but it is just one game, I guess, is ultimately a thing, and why I sense some amount of optimism from you despite the frustration that we experienced from the game on Saturday.
Well, yeah, I'm optimistic because the Big Ten West stinks so much.
Yeah.
It is so bad. So that's why I'm optimistic.
What a place to be, Ben. What a place to be. I mentioned the Nebraska game at the top. I just want to circle back to that because it was genuinely wild to watch, because they had a 4th-and-1 from the... And that, this is also what happened. Like, Iowa's sneaks are no longer automatic. Like, I mean,
talk about square peg round hole. Like, holy hell.
Yeah.
And
So the reason I brought up the sneak is... Adrian Martinez could not score from the goal line twice. One time, and this was hilarious. I'm going to recap it again in my ponks because it's just so ridiculous. Every part of Adrian Martinez crossed the goal line of a third down run, except for the part with the ball. Like his head, his shoulder, his foot, all across the goal line, ball not. And then on 4th down, they run some dumb play where they don't score. So, like, I think I'm in the clear with the over. And then I'm not, because Minnesota, they punted away. Somehow Nebraska has the ball on the other goal line. Safety on a throw. I just couldn't believe it. And then two meaningless touchdowns. The over hits. Not a bad beat because...
Holding in the end zone, right? Was the safety...
Yeah. Or no, it was intentional grounding because threw it away.
Yeah.
Threw it away. Incredible. That was a fun one.
I've always said the Nebraska game doesn't really worry me because there's no way Adrian Martinez is making it 12 games or whatever it is this year. If he's not down by now, then he's made a fucking Mylar. He's impossible to hurt. So we're going to see a fully healthy Adrian Martinez on Black Friday. And if Nebraska is fighting, if they've got 5 wins at that game, if they're fighting for bowl eligibility, potentially Scott Frost's job, that's the last team I'd rather play Georgia or Alabama than that Nebraska team.
The only reason I disagree is because if you get the Mylar Adrian Martinez. You can't spell Adrian without Adrian Martinez. No, you can.
Nice. Nice.
He's always prone to just 2 or 3 game-breakingly dumb decisions because so much is put on his shoulders. And
yeah,
we might see him. I haven't even looked at the Big Ten schedule coming up this week. Like, I've been...
It's gross. Overall, this college football week stinks. There's not a single game between 2 ranked teams.
Because what I see, it was the big game of the week is almost Iowa State, Oklahoma State.
Yeah. That's it. That's the best game of the week. I think there's Wisconsin. I think Wisconsin plays Purdue, right? So that's like...
Oh, and that one, too. You're right.
That's kind of important. But like Michigan plays Maryland, I think, or Penn State plays Maryland. Penn State plays Illinois. Michigan plays Northwestern. Like, it's gross. Maryland and Minnesota, fucking kill me. Ohio State, Indiana again. I don't know what's going on there. whatever. It'd be a good weekend to go back and to my pumpkin patch and take a nap.
I'm pumpkin patching it. That is for sure. Maybe I commit to being a Purdue fan the rest of the season, because I know the second I do that, they will lose in heartbreaking fashion.
Do it for us. Yeah,
I know.
What are you gonna say?
No, just exactly what you were gonna say. Do it for the reverse jinx.
Yeah, I wish you could see how bad my pumpkin is that I carved. It is
an abomination. Where is it?
It's on my back deck.
I'll
save it for our Patreon subscribers. But it is. talk about Halloween nightmares and scary movies. My pumpkin, let me tell you, it's bad.
Did you just try and do the jack-o'-lantern, or was it supposed to be something else?
No, I mean, I bought a pumpkin carving kit, and it came with like 20 stencils, and I chose, it's actually kind of cute. It ranked how difficult each stencil was based on, like, this is 5 pumpkins, so it's impossible. And I think mine was 2 or 3 pumpkins, trying to impress the person I was carving pumpkins with. And I mean, I chose moderate, and I'm a one pumpkin man who took on a 3 pumpkin job, and it shows.
How did the other pumpkin turn out?
Incredible. Hers looks so good. It's perfect. It's really put in my place.
The classic overconfidence. Toxic masculinity at its finest.
Which is something I've never been accused of, by the way.
God. I know, I'm kidding. It was a bad joke.
It was good. This was all good. This is all 60 minutes of gold.
Fantastic. Well, Ben, we are right at the hour mark. That's incredible. Anything else you want to add?
No, I mean, I was on a bye this week. The Vikings are on a bye this week. I think it's going to be a little too cold to golf. I don't know what I'm going to do. College football is crappy.
I think, yeah, back we'll to have the pumpkin patch.
Baseball, I guess, yeah. Right.
I'm trying to think. The one thing I want to re-bring up is the school pictures that they put Elliot through.
Oh, my God. Those are good.
I sent those to the Slack channel, and the boy had been through it.
It's tough. You made me remember, it's like, when we took, I remember my mom always rooting those out every few years, like, we would have like stage, like babbling brooks and like fake rocks for ours. And it kind of, Elliot's almost were just like a shade, because it's somewhere in black and white, which is a move I've never seen before, which I really appreciate. But when you go to black and white, you get sort of like the old timey pictures you would take at, fair or whatever. A fair or a carnival. And I really like how Life Touch has made some advancements in that department and their business model.
Yeah, incredible stuff. Incredible stuff. Well, I'll probably share them when we get the digital copies to the internet. Not getting all 8, because is a hefty price to pay. But
should we have a Squid Game podcast?
Oh, we can probably do that. Yeah, let's do that. Let's talk about that next week. We'll talk about that in basketball next week.
Cool.
Okay. All right. Producing and a podcast, per usual. All right. For Ben Ross, for John Johnston, the coordination dude who went on that hilarious rant, and for myself, Harrison Starr, go Hawks. Enjoy the off week.
Red light.